Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. When we left off last season, the spring of 1775 had already ignited into full-scale conflict. The first shots at Lexington and Concord didn't just rattle the countryside, they echoed around the world, signaling that the colonies were ready to resist. In Virginia, tensions were boiling over. Lord Dunmore's seizure of the Williamsburg Gunpowder Magazine pushed colonists to the edge, making clear that this was no longer a political quarrel, but a fight with real immediate stakes. It was in this tense, uncertain moment that the Second Continental Congress convened, tasked with shaping a military response to a rebellion that was suddenly becoming a war. And it was here, in June of 1775, that George Washington emerged as a figure whose presence would come to define the struggle itself. Appointed commander-in-chief of the newly formed Continental Army, Washington was, on paper, just one man, but his reputation, his courage, and his leadership would soon make him indispensable. Today, we're joined by Lindsay Chervinsky, Executive Director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon, to unpack this critical turning point. We'll explore how Congress came to place so much trust in a single individual, how Washington navigated the early challenges of command, and why his role would shape not only the Army, but the future of the nation itself.
I'm Lindsay Chervinsky. I'm the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon, and I'm a presidential historian and author of several books. In my day job, I manage the library, the archives at Mount Vernon, the collections, our public programming events for adult audiences, our digital resources, and our Leadership Institute. And then I bring that on the road through media, public-facing writing, and public speaking to try and make sure everyone knows what it is that we're doing here and how they can participate.
The Second Continental Congress convened on May 10th, 1775, in Philadelphia. And this time, the stakes were different. This wasn't just a follow-up meeting on the calendar, but a deliberate continuation of the First Continental Congress's efforts, building on its boycotts and petitions to repeal the Intolerable Acts by regrouping, assessing, and deciding the next steps if Britain failed to respond. But events in April had shifted everything. The Congress now faced a colony on edge and the urgent need to coordinate a response to mounting tensions. Plans for petitions and diplomacy shared space with the reality of an increasingly volatile situation. The choices made in those early days would not only define the Congress's role, but also set the foundation for the emerging Continental Army and the larger fight for independence.
By the time the Second Continental Congress had gathered in the spring of 1775, the war was effectively underway. The battles of Lexington and Concord had occurred on April 19, 1775, and they all realized it was going to be very difficult to go back to the status quo after blood was shed.
Suddenly, the Continental Congress found itself in charge of a war effort, but the colonial representatives were far from a unified voice. For some, the conflict had already justified taking up arms against the crown. Others worried about the deep differences between the colonies and what it would take to transform a patchwork of militias and local volunteers into a force capable of standing against the British Empire. The Congress faced more than strategic difficulty. It faced the challenge of unity. They needed a leader who could bridge these divides, inspire confidence, and turn disparate groups into an army. Every decision in those early days would shape not just the war, but the very possibility of a new nation emerging from the colony struggle.
1775 is a real tipping point for a number of reasons. For some people like Washington, once war was underway, then that was it. Now, there is a lot of evidence that he had probably gotten to that place already. He had started to feel resentment about what he thought was basically second-class citizenship in a lot of different elements of his life, economic opportunity, political opportunity, professional opportunity, as early as the 1750s. But by 1775, for him, once war was underway, then it was a done deal. And he probably shared that perspective with people like John Adams and Sam Adams, who were definitely among the more ardent patriots or early adopters of ardent patriotism in the Continental Congress. For others like Thomas Jefferson, they of course would get there. Jefferson penned the draft of the Declaration of Independence. But I think there is good evidence to suggest that things like Dunmore's Proclamation, which basically encouraged enslaved individuals in Virginia to run away and join the British lines, probably were even more powerful for Jefferson because it was so close to home and would have such a powerful impact on his day-to-day existence. Whereas for him, not having been a soldier, not having had any military experience, Lexington and Concord maybe felt quite distant. And then there was a third group, people like John Dickinson, who still thought the time wasn't ripe. They believed that independence perhaps was inevitable, but they recognized that the colonies had very little in common, that they didn't have a unified process. And so they thought that war would be quite deadly and would be doomed to fail at this point. So there was a real question of how do you bring together the colonies? How do you bring together the delegates at the Continental Congress? How do you bring together the various militias that are representing the different colonies and have a long tradition of doing so, recognizing that this war had begun, whether or not they were actually going to declare independence. For all effective purposes, there were a lot of troops surrounding Boston who had already made that decision for them. And so there was a real pressing concern about even if they weren't yet ready to say those words out loud, how do they in practice start to tip towards that process?
Ultimately, the Continental Congress adopted what we might call a best of both worlds approach. They prepared for the war that many delegates advocated for and that almost everyone knew was coming, while also making one final attempt at peace with King George III. On June 14, 1775, the Congress voted to form the Continental Army. The very next day, they named George Washington as commander-in-chief, placing the weight of the colony's hopes on his shoulders. In July, Congress also sent the Olive Branch Petition, a last gesture of loyalty to the crown, conditional on Parliament and the king addressing the grievances that colonists had long raised. But by the time the petition reached London, King George had already declared the colonies in open rebellion. He refused to even read it, leaving reconciliation impossible and confirming that armed conflict was now unavoidable. The failure of diplomacy only sharpened the urgency for strong leadership. The fledgling Congress faced the immense task of organizing a military force from scratch while also establishing the structures of a temporary government capable of guiding a divided set of colonies through war. Every decision mattered. Every choice carried the weight of survival. It was in this moment of uncertainty and necessity that George Washington emerged, not just as a military figure, but as a symbol of the cause itself. We are often told that his appointment was a foregone conclusion, but understanding why he was chosen reveals as much about the man as it does about the stakes facing the American Revolution.
There are three factors that I think the Continental Congress was quite mindful about, and then there was a fourth intangible category. The three factors, and these are well articulated by John Adams, who engineered the nomination of George Washington and really ensured he was the choice. The first was that this person had to be born in the future United States because they needed to be quite sure that their loyalty was unquestioned. And so you needed to have an American-born future commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. The second consideration is, of course, they had to have military experience, but they really didn't want someone who had actually held a commission as a British officer, because again, it would undermine the certainty about the loyalty of this person. And they needed to know that the command would not be questioned for that reason. And so that ruled out people like Horatio Gates and Charles Lee, who had a lot of military service, but had actually been in the British Army. The third factor, and this is perhaps the most important, is it needed to be someone outside of Massachusetts. Ideally, it needed to be someone from the South, and extra ideally, it needed to be someone from Virginia, which was the largest, most powerful, and wealthiest state. And that was especially important because they were trying to demonstrate that this was a national movement, that this was not about New England, this was not about Boston. And a lot of Britons felt that Bostonians were the rabble-rousers. They were not totally wrong in that sense that, you know, Bostonians did tend to be farther out in front of others, but it was essential for the Continental Congress that they demonstrated that all of the states, including Virginia, were equally in this fight. And so George Washington fit all three of those categories in a way that almost no one else did. The last category, which was the intangible, was that he looked like a leader. He was tall, he was muscular, he walked into a room and people took notice. And those might sound like frivolous things, but they're actually really important when you're trying to get people to follow you. For Washington, he was an excellent dancer and he was said to be the best horseman of his age. And those were the pinnacle of masculinity elements that were treasured in the 18th century. And if you are going to lead troops into battle, it's probably a good thing that you have a good seat on a horse. So he had a lot of the intangible elements of leadership that sometimes are easy to poo-poo, but are actually really important.
And so in the end, no one else was seriously considered for the role of commander in chief. But it's important to note, this wasn't a position forced upon Washington. He accepted the responsibility, fully aware of the challenges ahead, ready to lead where others might hesitate.
I should say the last piece, which just in case anyone forgot that Washington might have maybe fit those categories, he did show up to the Second Continental Congress in military uniform. Washington designed his uniform for himself, and it was custom made, which is one of the reasons it fit so well. It had a navy jacket and what are often called buff breeches. So this is not really a brown, it's not really a gold, it's kind of in between. And this was both a nod to the Whig Party in Britain, which typically adopted the colors buff and blue. It is also a distinctly American uniform because it is rejecting the reds of the British regulars. And as he went forward as commander in chief, he was very intentional about ensuring that all of the uniforms that his men and his officers wore were distinctly American and were carving out a different sartorial tradition than the British Army. So this was a case of dressing for the job you want, and he wanted that job.
So George Washington shows up to that meeting in Philadelphia, dressed in a custom military uniform, standing taller than most of the men in the room. The Continental Congress is searching for a leader, and everyone there knows that the choice they make will define the army, and perhaps the revolution itself. On the surface, Washington's presence reads like a man stepping into destiny. And yet, only a few days later, he writes a letter to his stepson, John Park Custis, Jackie, held now in the VMHC collection, saying, "It is an honor I neither sought after or was by any means fond of accepting." How can both of these things be true? How can a man appear so prepared, so commanding, and yet claim reluctance to assume the role? The answer lies in Washington's character. He understood the weight of responsibility, the danger, and the personal sacrifices the position demanded. He recognized that the cause needed him, and he was willing to rise to that necessity, even as he acknowledged its burdens.
It's really important we acknowledge that people can have a lot of humility about their own shortcomings or their own flaws and also still be intensely ambitious. And Washington was intensely ambitious. It's also important we distinguish between these earlier positions and his later positioning on the presidency, because Washington did not want to be president, but he also understood that no one else could fill that role. And so that is the moment where, when he's sort of demurring about this public service, he means it. And he is doing it only because he is called to that position. As commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, he wanted the role. He liked the idea of being in power. He clearly dressed to remind people that he could do this job. He resented attempts to undermine his authority. During the war, there were some attempts to replace him with people like Horatio Gates, and he was very savvy about defeating those attempts. But that also doesn't mean that he didn't have humility. He understood what he was good at and what he wasn't good at. He surrounded himself with people that were smarter and more experienced than him, and he sought out their perspective. So people can be both things at one time. Now, we don't have a whole lot of evidence about him outwardly campaigning for this job, and that frankly seems pretty inconsistent with a lot of the other ways that he managed his public persona. But we do know that he regularly socialized with all of the other delegates at Continental Congress. He knew them well. He had been respected in the Virginia House of Burgesses and had been an early voice for some of the resistance measures towards independence, including the Fairfax Resolves in 1774. So I think through his socialization, his relationship building, what we might call networking, he put himself in a position to be well-respected such that the vote was actually unanimous to appoint him as commander-in-chief. There was an expectation in 18th century culture that men were not supposed to seek out positions of authority. They were supposed to be called to those and accept them reluctantly, but with willingness to serve on behalf of their peers if that's what their peers wanted. So a lot of Washington's letters about his command as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army reflect this tradition, reflect this understanding that he is supposed to appear unwilling to seek out the authority, but willing to take it if someone trusts it. Now, that doesn't mean that he wasn't nervous about what was before him or that he didn't recognize the stakes. Sometimes when he talks about not being up to the challenge, I do believe that sentiment, because if he fails, he's going to get hung as a traitor. So he understood the stakes and the challenge of trying to defeat the largest army and navy in the world. But he wanted it. He wanted the position. He wanted the honor. He wanted the glory of being the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, even if later on those protestations were much more accurate.
One of the Continental Congress's biggest concerns was unifying the colonies, each with its own culture, economy, and priorities. Not just in ideology, but in practical terms as well. George Washington became their solution. From the very beginning, his focus as a leader was on forging a shared identity. He needed to convince the colonists that they weren't just not British, but that their common cause was something larger, that together they were American. Every early decision, every speech, every order was part of building not just an army, but a sense of nationhood, bound by purpose and possibility.
Washington's appointment was essential towards unifying the army, but also I see as the first step of national identity formation. It happens in a couple of ways. So it is very important to remember that when Washington met up with the army, and the first time he met up with them was on July 3rd, 1775. This was a ragtag group of militias from the New England states. They didn't know each other. They didn't have a unified command system. Most of the militias were very democratic in their organization, meaning they elected their officers, and the officers tended to not instill a whole lot of discipline because they wanted to be elected again. And also, their men were their neighbors. And so it's very difficult to order punishment for when you have to go home and farm side by side with your neighbor. So that led to things like the men didn't know how to build proper latrines and were contaminating their own drinking water. This is sort of basic army survival 101. And Washington was horrified when he got there and actually referred to these troops as dirty and nasty people. Now, he quickly began to change his own opinions of the troops and recognize the incredible sacrifice that a lot of these soldiers were making. They didn't have hundreds of enslaved people to care for their properties and their crops and their families, and instead were sacrificing potential financial futures and the health and safety of their family for this cause. So it took Washington a little while, but he began to develop a real respect for these men. When he was there, one of the first things he did was he issued his second general order on July 4th, 1775. And this second general order said to the army, "You are no longer a group of militia. You are now the unified forces of North America. And Congress urges you to set aside your regional differences and competitions and instead basically compete to see who can be most loyal to this one unified cause." That is a remarkable statement to make a year before the Declaration of Independence was declared. And it is a recognition on his part and on Congress's part that they have claimed one of the first responsibilities of a sovereign nation, which is the use of military force. Things like Washington's command flag were essential. He selected a flag that was navy blue with 13 stars on it, which was a marked departure from the Union Jack of the British flag. And indeed, when Continental Congress finally adopted their own flag, they replaced the Union Jack in the left-hand corner of the flag with that blue background with 13 stars. So there was a recognition that what Washington was doing and the army was doing was establishing the symbolic steps towards having a national identity. Washington himself played a huge role in this process. By 1778, localities and towns and states were celebrating his birthday. And that's particularly important because the colonies had a tradition of celebrating the king's birthday. They obviously stopped that once the Declaration of Independence was declared. But those celebrations are essential for bringing people together and defining a common cause and something to aspire to. And in a lot of ways, Washington became essentially synonymous with the cause for independence. And he did so because the army would not exist without him. Congress started to refer to the army as Washington's army, as opposed to their army or the Continental Army, because they understood that if Washington was killed, captured, or replaced, the army would disintegrate. They were so loyal to him and so determined to follow his lead that without him, it would not exist. And Washington understood, and Congress understood, and eventually the British understood that as long as the army was in existence, could be 1,000 men, but as long as there were still a little group there willing to fight, then the cause for independence would survive. The British understood eventually that they could not subdue the entire continent without an army and an influx of resources that they were simply not willing to commit. And so eventually, everyone understood that as long as Washington was around, the cause for independence would survive too. And so he became synonymous with this movement.
It didn't happen overnight. Yes, from the start, people respected him. Washington had charm, elegance, a natural presence. But true loyalty, the kind that binds men to a leader, that takes time. It came through shared sacrifice, through hardship endured side by side, and above all, through his own personal courage. He walked willingly into danger, into fire, so often that his officers sometimes had to drag him out of the line of fire just to keep him alive. Steadily, the bond formed. And by the winter of 1777, it was undeniable. The army would go where Washington went. His loyalty, his legitimacy, his reputation, they had become inseparable from the army itself. The British, however, didn't necessarily feel the same sort of reverence, at least not initially.
They tried a lot of ways to sort of diminish his position. So there's the famous story of the British generals and admirals wanting to send him letters, and they send it to George Washington Esquire, which would have been the standard form of communication prior to the war. And he refused to respond because they were not recognizing his position, which was general or commander in chief. So that was an attempt to sort of undermine who he was. And he was very savvy to those attempts. Similarly, towards the end of the war, after the Battle of Yorktown, when Cornwallis surrendered, he sent his second in command, and the second in command tried to surrender to Washington, and he refused and handed it to his second in command to make sure that the ranks were appropriately parallel. But towards the end of the war, I think they started to think of him as, they often called him, I think, the wily old fox, because they developed a appreciation for his strategy, which was what we would think of today as an insurgent strategy. You don't have to take on the British army in a headfirst massive battle. You can kind of snipe at the edges of their flanks, and you can harass their baggage trains, and you can make it difficult for them to exist in North America, and that would be sufficient. So they began to appreciate his savvy about what was actually the goal of the war.
Washington also had to win over the people at home. He understood that a military reputation meant little if the Continental Army alienated local communities. The revolution had begun as a spark of popular discontent, and that fire could easily be snuffed out if ordinary colonists turned against the cause. Washington had to balance competing pressures, commanding troops, maintaining discipline, and also keeping the public on his side. Every action in camp, every order in the field, was measured not just by winning or losing the battle, but for its impact on the broader American audience, whose support could make or break the fight for independence.
In the early years of the war, Washington was very attentive to courting the local populations wherever they happened to be. So shortly after he arrived in Cambridge, Massachusetts in July of 1775, he went and he visited Abigail Adams, for example, and tried to woo the local elite, which he was actually quite effective at doing. She wrote a letter to John gushing over how wonderful this man was, which I'm sure he really appreciated. He did the same in places like New York and New Jersey. One of Washington's great strengths was an understanding that he had to both win the war militarily, or at least survive the war militarily, but he also had to win the hearts and minds of the American people. Because if he alienated the American population, then it didn't matter how he did on the battlefield. And so he was quite meticulous about trying to clamp down on pillaging and theft and things that armies sometimes do. He was not perfect at it. The army did behave badly, but he tried really hard. He was very reluctant to take food from local populations. He always wanted to ensure that they were paid for their services and their materials. And he was incredibly attentive to Congress. So he visited with Congress when they asked him to come. He encouraged delegations from Congress to come see the troops so they could see when he said that he needed more supplies, he was not blustering that they didn't have the clothing and the shoes and the arms that they needed to actually fight the war. And he always stayed close to the army such that when visitors did come, he could show them in those positions. But the army in its early years was very disorganized. The supply lines were incredibly disorganized because in 1775 and early 1776, Congress was basically dealing with this war and this army in haphazard fashion. It got a little bit better once Congress created the Board of War.
The Board of War was established by the Second Continental Congress in June of 1776 as a dedicated committee responsible for overseeing the administration of the Continental Army. Its creation marked an important step towards organizing a fledgling military force that was growing rapidly, but still largely improvised. As the war progressed, the demands of the board increased, requiring it to manage everything from recruitment and supply to logistics and communication across the sprawling colonies. To keep pace with these challenges, the board underwent multiple reorganizations, adjusting its structure and responsibilities to meet the evolving needs of the army and ensure that Washington and his officers could carry out the fight effectively. We've talked a lot about Virginia and Massachusetts working together in 74 and 75, but they weren't the only colonies at the table. The Second Continental Congress included all 13 colonies, each with its own priorities and concerns. From New Hampshire in the north to South Carolina in the south, delegates carried the weight of local politics, economies, and public opinions. Bringing all of these voices together was no small feat. It required negotiation, compromise, and a shared sense of purpose. Understanding who else was involved helps us see how the revolution wasn't just driven by a few influential colonies.
The other states that I think are particularly important at this time are, they're the big states. So, you know, Pennsylvania is hosting the Continental Congress. Of course, they're going to have an impact on the culture of how Congress is interacting with each other and its deliberations and the social elements. Pennsylvania had a very large Quaker population, which were pacifist and didn't want war. So that absolutely influenced both the discussions, but also some of the Pennsylvania delegates themselves, including John Dickinson. New York was not yet the biggest and most powerful state, but it was understood to be a growing city, and the port of New York City was understood to be probably the most important port going forward. So when its delegates received approval to vote for independence in 1776, that was a huge turning point. Because New York City culture tended to have very close ties with London, there were a lot of merchants. They did tend to be a little bit more loyalist in their leanings. And then the southern states, the far southern states, states like South Carolina and Georgia, they were thought to be more loyalist. And so bringing them around and also thinking about how to, especially as the war went on, thinking about how to fight a war in places where the Black population often outnumbered the white population became an increasingly complicated conversation.
Washington's appointment as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army marks a pivotal turning point, not just for the war, but for our understanding of him as a person. Early in his life, during the French and Indian War, Washington was ambitious, outspoken, and sometimes impulsive, as we see in his surviving letters and reports. By the time he assumes command in 1775, he has begun to temper that ambition with careful calculation. He is learning what leadership truly requires: measured judgment, patience, and the ability to inspire loyalty. At the same time, he is beginning to grasp the weight of his own legacy. The decisions he makes now, in the chaos and uncertainty of war, will shape not only the army, but how history remembers him. And this transformation is just one thread of change. From the first skirmishes to the final victory at Yorktown, we can trace shifts in Washington's character, his leadership style, and even his vision of what the new nation could become.
Washington changes in three distinct ways. So the first way was he became even more circumspect. And that was largely because he understood that his stature was just skyrocketing and that he was going to be written about, that if they survived and they won the war, that his papers and his person were going to be of enormous value to history and to the history books. And so he becomes more circumspect about his opinions, his feelings, his thoughts. He becomes much more protective about his own personal correspondence. And he is already thinking about how to protect that legacy because it is so treasured and important to him. The second key way is his leadership becomes even more savvy. He made a lot of mistakes early on in the war. Some of them are sort of cardinal sins. You don't split your army when you are the smaller force, things like that. Towards the end of the war, he was making smarter choices, and he was making much more determined choices to ensure the survival of the Republic. His role in the Newburgh conspiracy, undermining what was essentially a threat of military coup against Congress, was essential in ensuring that a republic actually survived. If you have military control of the government, you don't have a republic, you have something else. And he understood that and worked incredibly hard to ensure that the character of the republic remained as it ought to have been and remained consistent, at least with the hope of the principles in the Declaration of Independence. The last way is that it changed his idea on slavery. So Washington, prior to the war, had been very happy to buy and sell people. He moved families around and people around with very little thought for the impact on women, children, and their families. By the end of the war, he had committed to no longer buying and selling people. He worked very hard to not separate families whenever possible. And he started to think about ways that he might actually pursue emancipation, and which he achieved for the people that he legally controlled in his will. He was able to emancipate them upon the death of Martha. That required two distinct shifts. First, he became quite determined to ensure that Mount Vernon would be a profitable enterprise, because if he was in debt, the fastest way his heirs would get out of debt would be to sell off the enslaved people at Mount Vernon. And so therefore, he had to die in such a financial way that that would not happen. Second, he had to change his mentality quite significantly about what slavery meant. And that happened through witnessing free Black communities in Philadelphia and Baltimore and Boston, through interactions with people like Phyllis Wheatley, who had incredible talent. Even though she was an enslaved woman, she was still this incredible poet. But most importantly, it happened because of the incredible valor and bravery of the Black Americans that were fighting in the army, Many of them were fighting for their own personal liberty in addition to that of the nation. And it was impossible for Washington to see that and not change his mind.
In Virginia, a pivotal moment for Black individuals choosing to fight in the Revolution comes later in 1775, and stay tuned for future episodes. On November 14th, Lord Dunmore issued a proclamation offering freedom to any enslaved owned by, quote, rebels, or what we now call patriots, if those enslaved people joined the British Army. Southern slaveholders were furious, seeing this as a direct attack on their property and authority. George Washington, a slaveholder himself, was immediately concerned. Some enslaved people at Mount Vernon took the offer and fled to British lines. Beyond the threat to his estate, Washington initially opposed arming Black soldiers more broadly, reflecting Southern traditions and Virginia law that had barred enslaved people from carrying weapons for more than a century. But the reality of war began to change his thinking. Watching Black soldiers fight with courage in Northern militias and facing a desperate shortage of manpower in the Continental Army, Washington began to reconsider their role. What had started as a strict adherence to law and custom gradually evolved into a pragmatic recognition. The fight for independence might demand the service of enslaved and free Black soldiers. These early tensions foreshadowed the complicated, often contradictory ways that race, freedom, and military necessity would intersect throughout the war.
He had a need for more men and was not able to find a lot of white soldiers willing to do this work. And he saw that the British were doing so. And so it was a very savvy choice to shift his policy and be more welcoming to Black soldiers in the army.
By the end of the war, Washington's importance was unmistakable. He had kept the army together and sustained the revolution through its darkest years. Without him, the cause might not have survived. And the nation that followed his leadership through the war, who would soon look to him for stewardship in its infancy, might never have come to be.
Historians are often uncomfortable with the language, you know, like an indispensable person, because we like to have complexity in our answers. We like to acknowledge the role of a lot of different people and factors that can shape how events unfolded. But there were three moments in Washington's life where he was the indispensable man. The first was as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. The second was in the Constitutional Convention. And the third was as the first president. And he was essential as the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army because he understood the game they were playing. He understood that if he destroyed the character of the Republic, if he retained power himself, if he did not return his commission, if he allowed a military coup, all of which would have been easy temptations for most humans, then it wasn't worth winning a war. And so understanding the big stakes of what was actually at play here and what he was fighting for and keeping that small R Republican goal in mind was what made Washington extraordinary and was something that I think few others would have been able to do.
Thanks so much to Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky for sharing her insights on today's episode. The George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon is open by appointment for anyone interested in George Washington, colonial America, or the founding era, from scholar to student and everyone in between. Join us next time as we zoom in on the Third Virginia Convention in the summer and fall of 1775.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Riley Reynolds, Nicole Martirana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.